from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The alt-right movement is feeling pretty good these days. They've broken into the mainstream with talk of white power, white supremacy. Steve Bannon, who ran their big platform, Breitbart News, is headed for the White House with his boss, Donald Trump. This hour On Point, the white power alt-right movement and its dreams. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the new prominence of the alt-right? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's hear the sound right away. This was just over a week ago. So-called white nationalists gathered at the Ronald Reagan Building, federal building in Washington, for the annual conference of the National Policy Institute. Here's video released by The Atlantic. This is Richard Spencer, president of the Institute, the man who coined the phrase alt-right, celebrating white supremacy.
America was, until this past generation, a white country designed for ourselves and our posterity. It is our creation. It is our inheritance. And it belongs to us.
The man who claims to have coined the term alt-right and feeling pretty good these days. Here he was in an interview with NPR's Kelly McEvers on November 17th, saying that his movement is here to stay.
This is the first time we've really entered the mainstream, and we're not going away. I mean, this is just the beginning, and I'm very excited.
Here we are. Later this hour, we'll look at Cuba's future after the death of Fidel Castro. But first, white power, white supremacists, and the alt-right. Joining me now from San Francisco is Josh Harkinson, senior reporter for Mother Jones. He's done extensive reporting on the movement. One recent piece headlined, White Nationalists See Trump as Their Troll-in-Chief. Is He With Them? You can link to his stories at our website, onpointradio.org. Josh Harkinson, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be here.
And with us from Montgomery, Alabama, is Richard Cohen. He's president of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The SPLC is a nonprofit established back in the early 70s, monitors hate groups, combats them in court. Richard Cohen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, Josh.
Richard Cohen, from your group's research and observation, how would you describe and define the alt-right today?
We would define it as a rebranding of white supremacy for the digital age. You know, the term alt-right is a little antiseptic, and, you know, I think it's dangerous for that reason. When you listen to someone like Spencer, that little clip that you played earlier, it makes it clear that white hegemony is what he's after.
Josh Harkinson, is that clear when you speak with members of the alt-right? Is it just a portion of the so-called alt-right? How would you describe it?
Well, I think white nationalism or white supremacy is a core aspect of the alt-right, although I would point out that there are people who call themselves alt-right who might be more focused on, say, combating feminism, the so-called men's rights movement, or, you know, might be a bit more focused on Islam, such as Steve Bannon, Trump's chief strategist. So it is a sort of catch-all that I think is intended to cover a range of far-right groups. But I think that it is true that it's essentially, its core is really white nationalism, white supremacy.
Richard Cohen, is it fair to look at Richard Spencer as a primary torchbearer for this movement?
I think it is. He's the one who coined the phrase. He's the one who Breitbart has lauded as one of the intellectual godfathers of the movement, he and Jared Taylor. So I think it's perfectly appropriate. I think Josh is right. There are some other folk who are linked to it because it's, you know, big and bad. But again, I think that Richard Spencer really is the premier person, the premier spokesperson for the essence of the alt-right.
Let's hear a little more then from him. Here he was at that gathering in Washington weekend before last, delivering a speech. And this is the one where Nazi salutes were popping up in the audience, speech delivering or romanticizing, I guess you might say, white superiority.
Within the very blood in our veins as children of the sun lies the potential for greatness. That is the great struggle we are called to. We are not meant to live in shame and weakness and disgrace. We were not meant to beg for moral validation from some of the most despicable creatures to ever populate the planet. We were meant to overcome all of it, because that is natural and normal for us.
Josh Harkinson, the video that came out of that meeting, I have to say, to me, was jaw-dropping, remembering how many Americans died in World War II fighting Nazism, and to see Nazi salutes, kind of Sieg Heil salutes, and to have Richard Spencer, you know, talk about hail Trump, hail our people, hail victory. I mean, hail victory is a literal translation of Sieg Heil, right? Is that somehow fringy, super fringy within this group or not?
No, it's really not. I mean, you know, there are people within the alt-right who consider like swastikas or Nazi salutes to be kind of a joke. And, you know, the alt-right really sprang from these obscure online message boards like 4chan, where people would post swastikas, you know, kind of as an insult or a joke because it was just so offensive that it was supposed to sort of elicit a reaction. But there's a spectrum there. And the people who thought it was a joke, you know, they are not by any means the norm. You know, there are people who take it very seriously, and they sort of coexisted in that online space, and that gave rise to what the alt-right is now. So when Richard Spencer, you know, does a Nazi salute, he's sort of saying two things. He's saying, oh, I'm making a joke, but he's also saying, oh, actually, I do really kind of agree with a lot of what Hitler had to say.
Richard Cohen, I mean, you've followed groups that have been on the fringes of our society for a long time, not without their impact, but more or less on the fringes. What are you thinking as you see this enthusiasm and this confidence in the future? We heard Richard Spencer on that tape describing in the Trump years in the heart of the Capitol.
Look, it's a scary development. You know, we have hate marching into the mainstream. Typically, white supremacists sit out the election and say a pox on both their homes. Both parties are irredeemably corrupt. This time they had a champion in Mr. Trump, and they've been celebrating his election. And, of course, they also have a champion in Mr. Bannon, who is now, you know, Mr. Trump's chief strategist.
Josh, we heard Richard Spencer interviewed on NPR, and part of the argument that I heard there was, look, we live in a multicultural time. Other races champion their qualities and their merits, and we just want equal time.
Right. That's what he says. You know, he says, well, why can't, you know, if African-Americans can have the NAACP or the Congressional Black Caucus, then why can't there be an organization that represents white people or a Congressional White Caucus? And, you know, I think people hear that and some people may say, oh, well, maybe you're right, because it does sort of on its face have an air of equality to it. But of course, you know, it completely misses the point that the majority of people in Congress are white, and that, you know, white interests essentially dominate American society. But I think he is playing on this idea of identity politics. He's saying, you know, if there's an identity politics for people of color, then, you know, people who are white deserve to be able to play ball the same way.
Here's a little sound of that. This is the alt-right website American Renaissance. Its editor, Jared Taylor, prominent figure here, spoke to the significance of Donald Trump's, he said, victory.
Our rulers are shocked to discover that white people have discovered they have interests too. That is Donald Trump's great achievement, to have been the standard bearer, even if unconsciously, of white interests. The sleeping giant has been stirring for some time, and Mr. Trump gave it a voice and a reason to act.
Richard Cohen, what about the argument? We know, we hear about Black Lives Matter, we hear about La Raza. Hey, let white power be heard too.
The white power has been heard throughout our country's history. You know, Mr. Spencer was saying that white people built America. He's doing it from D.C., a place where slave labor built the Capitol. Slave labor built the White House. So our country's always been dominated by white people. Black Lives Matter, other groups that have been long marginalized are trying to say, we want to be part of the American dream. We can't be marginalized any longer. Not to recognize the disparity of power between white people and people of color is to be blind to the reality of our country's history and our country's current situation.
Josh, how do you read the enthusiasm that we heard Richard Spencer sharing there for the moment here, for his movement? Is it an atmosphere that's been created, or is it through Steve Bannon, the sense that they have direct access to the new administration?
Well, you know, it goes beyond Steve Bannon, you know, you really have to go back to when Donald Trump first launched his presidential campaign. I mean, he was a hero to people on the alt-right, to white supremacists and their ilk, because of the fact that he championed the birther cause, that he was one of the people leading the accusations that Barack Obama was not a citizen of the United States, which, of course, is deeply racist. And it was seen, you know, as a signal to these folks that he was one of them. And so then when he launched his presidential campaign, you know, the first thing he did was ride the escalator down to the first floor of the Trump Tower, and he proclaimed that, you know, he was going to deport Mexican rapists, etc. And it was the beginning of this year of sort of dog whistling to white supremacists by, you know, retweeting Twitter accounts that, you know, were run by white nationalists or white supremacists, by retweeting an image of himself as Pepe the Frog, which is the mascot of the alt-right, and a lot of other similar stuff. And so, you know, his appointment of Steve Bannon to the White House is sort of the icing on the cake. You know, he was signaling that he was one of them for a year, and now he has signaled that in the most concrete way possible, which is to give a champion of the alt-right a seat at the Oval Office.
Do you think, Richard Cohen, that the alt-right is looking forward to a real voice here, or just a kind of atmospheric connection, or is the distinction important?
Well, you know, I hope that the Trump administration sorely disappoints them. I mean, that's what I hope. I think that their hope is that their interest will be played out in the Trump administration, that we'll have harsh anti-immigrant laws, that will return stop and frisk, that we will surveil Muslim American communities. I think that that is their hope. I mean, their dream is a state defined by ethnicity rather than a state defined by our principles. You know, Richard Spencer wants to turn the Declaration of Independence on its head. His motto is, all men are created unequal. So I think that that's what their hope is.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at the white power, white supremacist, alt-right movement and its dreams, some of them now coming true in Washington and beyond, looking at who they are, what they want, and maybe asking whether Chief Trump strategist Steve Bannon is their new man in the White House or not. Richard Cohen is with us. He's president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, been working since the early 70s to monitor and fight hate groups in this country, joins us from Montgomery, Alabama. Josh Harkinson is here from San Francisco. Senior reporter for Mother Jones has done a lot of reporting on this movement, including, of late, their celebration at the Trump victory. You can join us this hour. Are you watching the rise of the language, the thinking, the voice of the alt-right's white supremacist views? Are you stunned? This is even part of the conversation in 21st century America. Are you stunned? It seems maybe connected to the White House. Is the mainstreaming of this a Trump creation from his campaign? In a multicultural America, does a white power perspective deserve a place at the table? Or is that out of bounds if this movement grows? Where does that lead? Joined in just a moment by former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis from South Carolina, a caller to first Dolores in Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hello to your guests. I'm 62. I've spent 20 years, I'm a military retiree, 20 years in the Army. I've had my head in the game in politics. I've been 13.
Yeah.
I have never been so scared for this country as I am now. These guys, Bannon, Spencer, they're totally unhinged. As you pointed out earlier, we had tens of millions of people die during the Second World War. And my father fought in that theater. I guess I want to know who in the Republican Party is going to have enough intestinal fortitude to stand up to these people and put us on the right course. I mean, these guys are totally unhinged, and I realize Southern Poverty Law Center, the NAACP, and other civil rights organizations have a road to hoe here because, you know, we are supposed to be welcoming everybody, and I just don't know who died and made the white race superior to anybody.
Dolores, you worked with it. You were in the Army. How would this view go down in the U.S. Army today, this white supremacist view?
Well, to be honest, let me tell you what. I spent 12 years in Germany, stationed in Germany, and at one point There were, I know on one installation we had a lot of racist tensions, but for the most part, I don't think this would go down well in the Army, especially, you know, amongst the your senior NCOs and the senior officers. This type of stuff would not be tolerated. It does exist. I mean, it does exist. But you have those fringe elements, but this would not go over well. I think the Army, in comparison to civilian society, did come a long way as far as race relations went.
Yeah, and you're asking now, who's going to stop this? Donald Trump was on 60 Minutes, and he talked a little bit about it. Leslie Stahl asked him, this was earlier this month, to address a rise in racial harassment, even hate crimes, since his victory.
They're harassing Latinos, Muslims.
I am so saddened to hear that, and I say stop it if it helps. I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera, stop it.
Stop it. But some have said that's just not enough. The disavowal to the New York Times editors, some are saying not enough. Some getting right out there. This is part of the crowd from Richard Spencer's event 2 weeks ago where we had those Nazi salutes going on, Hail Trump and all that. They went to a restaurant, Maggiano's, a Little Italy restaurant, and after that meeting, anti-fascist protesters poured into the restaurant to challenge them, condemn them. Getting messy out there. Former Republican congressman for South Carolina's 4th Congressional District, Bob Inglis, joins us right now. He's in the U.S. Congress in the 90s and again from 2005 to 2011. Was finally defeated by Trey Gowdy in 2010. He's now executive director of the Republican, a nonprofit, works with conservatives for free enterprise solutions to climate change. Bob Inglis, thank you very much for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
What do you think of the influence that this group, this movement has or does not have in the White House now, and how Donald Trump has responded to their new prominence?
Well, I share Dolores's concern, and Rich and Josh's concern expressed earlier, is that, I think what's happened here is Donald Trump has committed rhetorical war crimes against our country, and those war crimes have set some people loose to go say the things they're saying, and what we are concerned about is do the things they might do. And so it's nowhere near enough to look into the camera and simply say, stop it. It's this. You have to have full repentance for this war crime, these rhetorical war crimes.
That is such strong language. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I mean it to be as strong as that, is that the guy has talked to us and about some of us in a way that causes people to become unhinged, like has been said several times in the show. And those people need to be reined in. We need to remind them that, no, this is a country made up of many different people, and it is not appropriate to celebrate some sort of ethnicity over allegiance to the United States and to divide the country up that way. You know, as a conservative, what I find rather ironic about this situation is that we're the ones that have long criticized the left for identity politics, but now it looks like we have completely bought into that and that we are now promulgating the same mistake, which is to say, oh, it's all about identity. It's not about allegiance to this idea, this American ideal.
But President-elect Trump says he disavows all of this. You heard him there in 60 Minutes saying to those performing hate crimes, saying, stop it. Do you expect this movement to have real influence in this White House?
I'm concerned about it because, you know, it's what I think we can see here is sort of a wink and a nod to these folks. You know, the things that Josh and Rich were talking about earlier, these indications that he has profited, that Donald Trump has profited from these folks' passions, that he actually has stirred up those passions, that it's come to his benefit. And now, with a wink and a nod, he sort of says, well, it's all okay now because I looked into the camera, the 60 Minutes camera, and said, stop it. No, that doesn't absolve you, sir. You have to do much more than that to repair the tear that you've made in the fabric that is America.
Josh Harkinson, what about Steve Bannon? He headed up the Breitbart News. Breitbart News was a major forum for this kind of conversation. Is he a standard bearer, a torch bearer? He says he's not. He's now senior counsel and chief strategist for Donald Trump. What do we know about his honest view about this white power, white supremacist movement?
Well, he told Mother Jones over the summer at the Republican National Convention that Breitbart is, quote, the platform for the alt-right. Now, he defines alt-right differently than I think most people do at this point. He claims that it is not fundamentally about white nationalism or white supremacy, that it's a nationalist movement, not necessarily
economic nationalism, I think he told you.
Correct. Yet, you know, at the same time, he acknowledges that there are white nationalists who glom on to the alt-right, in his view. And he says that that's natural, that you're always going to have extremists in any political movement. I think that that claim that it's not inherently white nationalist is not really borne out by the facts. He may wish it to be that way, or he may talk about it that way. The other question is Steve Bannon actually racist? And I think that's hard to say. I mean, he said a few things that come off that way. He felt like there were too many people of Asian origin who were CEOs in Silicon Valley. He talked about how his at one point, according to his ex-wife, he had expressed concerns about his kids going to school with Jewish kids. But a lot of other people who know him say that he doesn't typically talk in racist terms. So he may be an opportunist, more than, a sort of true believer when it comes to capitalizing all this stuff.
Richard Cohen, we've got a former Breitbart editor just saying, look, Stephen Bannon is just a manipulator. He's mainstreamed far-right extremists for cynical political purposes. For power. You've got a former film collaborator of his saying he's using the alt-right, using them for power, not that he's part of them. Do you see a distinction, Richard?
You know, in Alabama, we used to discuss or have a debate about whether George Wallace was a racist at heart or just an opportunist. I thought it was a bit academic because, in the end, bad things happen to black people. And I think that's the same thing here. I think the discussion about what's in Steve Bannon's heart is a bit irrelevant. The question is, what has he done? And what he's done is bring white supremacy to the mainstream. He says, the white supremacist elements are going to be, and the anti-Semitic elements are going to be washed out of my nationalist movement in the long run. I wonder, what's the historic precedent for that? It reminds you of Marxists who used to say, they're sure we have the dictatorship of the proletariat, but, the state is going to wither away in the communist, kind of heaven. And, of course, it never happened there, and I don't know what historic precedent he points to say it's going to happen here once he lets these people under the tent or into the tent.
Dove in Nashville, Tennessee. Dove, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I find this topic very interesting, especially as a Jewish conservative living in the United States and also a citizen of Israel. One of the things that piques my interest the most is the fact that I've never heard of this term alt-right until the leftist media really just grabbed it by the horns and just wrote it all the way through, even to the point now where now it's becoming part of our daily lexicon. I mean, let's call this what it is. These are just neo-Nazi cockroaches that feel that they can now have the ability to come out from the shadows and out of their dark places. And as someone who's involved in security and very much concerned with the security of the Jewish people in the United States, I'm a little excited because now we can see who they are and we can see what they're doing. Now, whether it's regardless of Trump's providing them cover, and I can't really speak to that, but what I can definitely speak to is the culpability of the left-wing media in making this a thing.
Dove, you're losing me right there. I mean, Breitbart News made them a thing. The left-wing media, I don't know what's the role that you see. I'm not even sure who you mean exactly, but Breitbart News was the platform, as Steve Bannon himself says.
Well, that's fine. Breitbart News is only one media source, but if Breitbart News initially brought this alternate right or conservative terminology out, CNN, NPR, MSNBC, everybody has just taken it.
Should it be ignored when there's Nazi salutes in the shadow of the White House?
No, absolutely it should not be ignored. We should definitely take a look at it and examine it and look at the motives of these people. But at the same time, you have to recognize, wait a second, journalists have a responsibility to control the hype. I know that's difficult for somebody to think about when they're in the journalist field, but at the same time, I mean, come on, let's really think about this. Do these people have that much power? But at the same time, okay, so now they're out, now they're doing their salutes, they've been doing it in dark closets before, now we can see who they are, now law enforcement and security forces in the United States can take a look at, okay, we're going to keep a look at these knuckleheads.
Dove, I appreciate your call. We're talking about the rise of the white power, white supremacist alt-right movement, or at least their much greater exposure since the Trump campaign. Bob English, you're a former Republican listening there. Are a Republican, former Republican congressman. Is the media right to pay close attention to this now? Is it magnifying something that's marginal and maybe not so important?
I think we do have to pay attention to it, but it does bring up the question. It's sort of like the whole thing about Donald Trump's campaign is, you know, in a day when there were editors at news outlets, if I had made some claim against, say, a political opponent that was just completely outrageous, like that the vote is rigged or something like that, I think the major newspaper in my district would have said, Inglis, come back to me when you got something serious to talk about. We're not printing any story about that. But the thing that happened here is Donald Trump got away with saying outrageous things that had no basis in fact, and they were covered. So I really don't know quite how to handle that. It's a new day without editors.
Andrew in Boca Raton, Florida. Andrew, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. My concern is, and for full disclosure, I'm actually new to the United States. I'm only 2.5 years. I'm Canadian.
Okay.
But my concern is that if we're spending too much of the news cycle and too much of our, you know, mental energy and conversational cycle on what I think is a very, very small amount of the population and Trump backers, that we're going to miss, you know, the more important issues that got Trump's victory. And even Bernie Sanders said this, like, you know, the problems that we have with health insurance and, you know, middle-class wage stagnation and manufacturing jobs that have left the United States. Like those are extremely important. And my fear is, like I said, that, you know, if we spend too much time, you know, talking about this extremely small fringe group, that we're going to miss these big issues.
Andrew, I've got it, and I appreciate your call. I mean, I should say, before and certainly after the Trump victory, we've been all over the broader issues that you describe. Here we are, you know, almost in December now, and yes, we're talking about this after we saw those Nazi salutes in Washington. Josh, Josh Harkinson, what about the appropriate level of attention to this element within our political discourse now?
Well, there was a study by a social media analytics firm that came out recently that found that it was a study of 10,000 Trump supporters on Twitter, and it found that a third of them followed at least one white nationalist Twitter account. And there's a separate study that showed that there's been a 600% increase in white nationalist Twitter activity in recent years. So, you know, you look at stuff like that and then take with it the fact that Breitbart News has basically doubled its traffic over the last year or so. And consider the fact that Steve Bannon, you know, the guy who runs Breitbart, is now in the Oval Office. And I think that there's plenty of reason to talk about this stuff. But you do have to contextualize it. I mean, I actually I published a story last week that looked at the traffic to white supremacist websites. These are sites that openly claim that whites are superior, the Daily Stormer and Stormfront. And I found that over the past year, their traffic has basically been flat. So I don't think there's a real buy-in for white supremacy, but the kind of white nationalism, the so-called alt-light of Breitbart News, that's clearly something that's on the rise and Donald Trump has been fueling.
We will keep our eyes always on the big issues, but not ignore this one. Josh Harkinson with Mother Jones, we appreciate you being with us from San Francisco today. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bob Inglis at Republican, former Republican congressman, South Carolina. Mr. Inglis, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be with Tom.
And Richard Cohen in Montgomery, Alabama, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Richard Cohen, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
When we return, we're going to look at Fidel Castro and the future of Cuba.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Goldman Sachs. Get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy in the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth, plus much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The face of Cuba for almost 60 years, its biggest brand was its firebrand leader, Fidel Castro. Late Friday night, it was announced that he had died at age 90. Where does Cuba go now? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where do you see Cuba headed after Fidel Castro? On Saturday, following the news of Fidel Castro's death, Cuban Americans took to the streets of Miami to celebrate. Here, courtesy of CNN, what two of them had to say.
I've been waiting for 56 years for this night. I am so happy. I wish that my grandmother was alive. She died 6 months ago, and she would have died to see this.
In Cuba, not right out like that. Cuba has declared a 9-day period of mourning after the death of Fidel Castro. On Saturday, CNN interviewed Cubans in Havana. Here's one man's reaction. This is hard for all Cubans, he said. He was our leader, the leader of the Cuban Revolution. We have to continue to move forward, but with his ideals and the path he paved. With us now to look at the future of Cuba, post-Fidel Castro. First, Mimi Whitefield joins us, Cuba correspondent for the Miami Herald. And while she waits for her visa to come through to head down to Cuba, she joins us from Miami. Mimi, welcome to, back to On Point. It's great to have you here today.
Hi, Tom.
And joining me from Washington's William Leogrand, professor of government at American University, specializes in Latin American politics, U.S. foreign policy, author of Back Channel to Cuba, the hidden history of negotiations between Washington and Havana. William Leogrand, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Mimi, first to you. Is it possible to make out through this moment what may be coming here? What political dynamics are kicking in Cuba as we speak? Do you anticipate significant change? After all, his brother, Raul Castro, is still in power.
Many of the Cuban exiles hope that, what's happening now will be a prelude to a free Cuba. But in my view, nothing is going to change that fast in Cuba. The succession from Fidel Castro to his brother, Raul, took place a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And Raul is already engineering his own succession. And the most important thing for the Cuban government is maintaining control. And they have neither the capacity or the appetite for rapid change. There could be some unknown factors thrown into the equation. One is the declining economy and their benefactor, Venezuela. Cubans may tire of the slow pace of economic change in Cuba because the economy is definitely on the rails.
William Leogrand in Washington, what do you see about what Cubans value in the Fidel Castro legacy and what they might want to jettison? And does the jettisoning part portend to you significant political change there?
So I think two things that Cubans to this day respect about Fidel Castro. One was that he was able to achieve Cuba's complete independence and sovereignty from the United States, which had dominated the island since 1898. And second, the social welfare system that he put in place, free health care, free education, a guaranteed job for everyone, and social security. The things that didn't work and that I think Cubans are today most unhappy about are as Mimi said, first the economy, which is stagnant. I mean, the old Soviet-style central planning system never really worked, and they're in the process now of trying to transition to a market socialist economy like China, but they're at the very beginning of that stage. And secondly, a political system, which is a closed political system, doesn't really have mechanisms for ordinary Cubans to express their point of view effectively or hold leaders accountable.
How significant do you see the depth of dissatisfaction with the economy and maybe with the politics? Is there enough there to push Cuba toward change, or in the ratio of power between that system and whatever dissatisfaction is there, does it pretend status quo to you?
Well, Cuba is already changing. It's been changing since Raul became president and began this process of economic reform. People are still deeply dissatisfied with the economy, and the changes haven't really soaked down yet to improve the standard of living of most ordinary people. But at the same time, I think Cubans are hopeful that this process will eventually improve the situation, and they're also anxious about the possibility of instability and violence, which they don't want to see. So as long as there's a sense that this reform process is moving forward, even gradually, I think that the situation there will remain reasonably stable.
Here was the Cuban leader Raul Castro on Friday night making the formal announcement that his brother Fidel had died.
Querido pueblo de Cuba, con profundo dolor,
dear people of Cuba, he said, with deep sadness, I inform our people, the friends of our America and the world, that today, November 25th, 2016, at 10:29 in the night, the commander-in-chief of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro Ruz, has died.
A las 10:29 horas de la noche, falleció el comandante en jefe de la Revolución Cubana, Fidel Castro Ruz.
Has died. From Raul Castro there. And he was Fidel Castro himself on the streets in Havana in 1999, celebrating then with an adoring crowd the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. Defiant and proud, he said then, to have fended off the attention, so we say, of 9 different American presidential administrations.
No habría Cuba. No habría podido resistir la hostilidad de 9 presidentes de Estados Unidos, que con excepción de
Fidel Castro in 1999, saying Cuba is still resisting the hostility of 9 U.S. presidents, who, with the exception of Carter, he said then, I can say with all honesty, were hostile and violent against our homeland. Now here we are, 2016, and at 90, Fidel Castro is gone. Sam in Miami, Florida. Sam, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been living in Miami for over 20 years now, and what I see is since Fidel Castro really kind of left the scene after his illness and Raul took over, he pretty much kept the status quo. So I'm not sure that all the celebration that's happening here is... it's really, I guess, the death of the symbolism and what really Fidel Castro stood for, rather than real change. And I think Raul Castro has pretty much kept the status quo. I mean, it slowly have opened up a little bit, and talking with President Obama did kind of open things up a little bit. But I don't see that this will cause any immediate change. I don't think... we have to be hopeful, but, really immediate change, immediate opening and democracy as we know it, I really see it really far-fetched as long as the Castros are in power.
What do you see down the road, Sam? Look 5 or 10 years down the road. What do you, as a Cuban emigre, what do you see coming?
I mean, I'm actually immigrated from Brazil here, a lot of Cuban, having a lot of Cuban friends and knowing their stories and everything they've gone through, even to this day, people are still, almost dying to get here. So things are not good over there for them, even, after Raul has been in power for this long. I think for the next 5 to 10 years, I think if the U.S. Continues to, press on opening up Cuba and continue conversations, I think that's a positive move towards the future. I think we have to keep this going. I do believe that Raul is probably not as hardline, and he sees a more open Cuba in the future based on his, you know, behavior and his openness in talking to President Obama lately. I think it's in a positive direction. I think it's too slow. It could be a lot faster than what's going on now, but I think it's going in the right direction.
Sam, I appreciate your call. Mimi Whitefield, what about what's changed and what has not changed in the years of Raul Castro's leadership?
Well, one of the main things that he has done is made changes, more market-oriented economic changes. So he's opened the economic scene for private business, private cooperatives. Under his watch, Cubans can more freely leave the island and come back, although many are choosing to, if they make their way to the United States, stay and take advantage of the Cuban Adjustment Act. Also, during his watch, Cuba has embraced foreign investment. They're actively courting it, saying they now need it for the economic development of the island, that it is, in fact, essential now.
So bring on the foreign money. That's different than changing a whole system. Bill in Hull, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking the call.
Yeah.
I just have a quick question for your panel.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what they think the future holds for the softening of relations between the United States and Cuba that finally, after 55, 60 years, has been implemented under President Obama. Obama's got 2 months left, and then we're going to get a Trump administration, which I would imagine, and kind of in light of the previous hour, would try to reverse all of this. I wonder what the panel thinks will happen with the softening of relations once the Trump administration takes over.
William,
thanks for taking the call.
Thank you, Bill. William Lilligrand, what do you anticipate when the Trump administration moves in terms of how they may treat the Obama opening, softening, and facing a Cuba without Fidel at all?
Well, just this morning, Mr. Trump tweeted that if Cuba wasn't willing to negotiate a better deal, then the deal would be off, is how he put it. Now, the reality, of course, is that U.S.-Cuban relations are a complex fabric of bilateral agreements that we've reached with Cuba over the years, regulatory changes that President Obama made that opened up business and travel. So it's a complicated relationship. But I think the point that Mr. Trump was making is that he would roll back Obama's opening to Cuba toward a more of a policy of hostility that we had during the Cold War. But that, at least, I will say, is more flexible than he was during the campaign itself, when down in Miami speaking to Cuban Americans, he said just flatly he was going to roll back everything that Obama had done.
And, of course, we got the first commercial flight from the U.S. going into Cuba today. I mean, what could he ask for from Cuba in that agreement? Is it even an agreement, William Lilligrand?
Actually, almost all of the changes that Obama made that have opened up travel and have opened up commercial relations with Cuba were done unilaterally by the president, because he believed that they were in the interests of the United States, and that by opening up to Cuba, we would actually create an environment that would encourage change on the island itself. So there isn't actually a deal, a tangible deal there. But what Mr. Trump has said is that he's going to demand from Cuba some concessions on political freedom, religious freedom, and economic freedom. I'm afraid he's going to be disappointed if he thinks he can make those kinds of demands and that the Cuban leaders are just going to roll over and agree to them. This is a leadership that survived the Bay of Pigs, survived the Cuban Missile Crisis, survived assassination attempts by the United States, and 50 years of the most thorough economic sanctions we have on any country in the world. So I don't think they're going to be making major concessions anytime soon.
We're talking about Cuba after Fidel Castro. Of course, first commercial flights into Havana today. They've been into Cuba already. Jeremy in Nashville. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would like to offer a different, basically, picture of Cuba as I've come to understand it from not only reading, but also from being part of a Mexican family that has traveled there numerous times over the last number of decades.
Let's hear it.
And, you know, when Fidel came into power, he was kicking out a dictator who had created a big disparity in equality in that country, and his value was to create equality in a country. Now, of course, Fidel was not perfect, and I think the embargo created a lot of hardship that caused him to do a lot of the things he did. But, you know, he did create a country where people have incredible health care. People have incredible education. No one is hungry, you know. I mean, people probably would like to eat more meat, you know, but no one's starving. And I think that, yes, there's a lot of Cuban Americans who have come here because people aspire to have iPhones and televisions and be able to be anything they want to be. And that's great. But, you know, from the people that I know have gone there, I mean, what you have is a culture of people that are confident in who they are. You know, they have lots of time to celebrate and party and relax. They're not working their tails off to try to make ends meet. They're cared for. And, you know, especially the people in the rural lands are incredibly happy people. They are self-sufficient, and they have created a quality of life that I think is really hard to match in a lot of other places.
And Jeremy, so, we've got it, and our time is short. Mimi Whitefield, you travel to Cuba often. You'll be there again soon. What about the balance of satisfaction versus dissatisfaction in Cuba today?
Well, everybody I've talked to certainly wants to improve their economic lot in life, and many do say now that they don't particularly like their form of government, but in addition to the education and the free health care, what it has given them is a very low crime rate and also a sense of tranquility. There are no violent street protests, and they look around Latin America and they're a little afraid of this type of thing.
The world that Fidel Castro created and Raul Castro has carried on with a new future now lying before it. Mimi Whitefield will be headed down for the Miami Herald very soon. Mimi, I hope we can talk to you after you've taken the temperature lately. Thanks so much for being with us today from Miami.
Thank you, Tom.
And William Leogrand at American University in Washington. William Leogrand, thank you so much for your thoughts as Fidel Castro passes from the scene. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.